New endeavors. Kick it, boys. Good afternoon, Radioland, and welcome to Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, up atop Simon Fraser University on Burnaby Mountain. We're also on the internet at cjsf.ca, where we stream and podcast all your favorite CJSF shows, as well as TELUS HD channel 7014. It feels good to be back. I've been off for a couple of weeks. I was doing some work at some music festivals over in Pemberton for the Pemberton Music Festivals, and then all the way over in Golden, BC for the Motion Notion Festival, which is quite a happening electronic music festival right on our lovely border with Alberta. But it feels good to be back. And what a show we're going to have for you today. From GLAAD, the wondrous advocacy group in honor of Pride, we have actor and LGBT advocate Omar Sharif Jr. He is the grandson of the famous actor Omar Sharif. And Omar Jr. has an interesting story. Born and raised in Egypt, he's Arab. He's also gay and half Jewish. So he tells his story. You know, what was it like growing up gay and Jewish in Egypt? You know, his grandfather's legacy, his involvement in acting, and his involvement with GLAAD. It's a very, very fascinating insight into so many minorities converging at once. Also, you'll hear from Iranian film scholar Jamshid Akrami. He is talking about the new film Closed Curtain. Closed Curtain is write or direct the film. He is a scholar who is talking about it. Because the director of the film is kind of forbidden from making cinema by the Iranian government. His name is Jafar Panahi, and the Iranian government a few years ago imposed a 20-year ban on filmmaking from him, but this is his second film, and he co-directed it with Kambuja Partovi. So Mr. Akrami will be talking to us about that. And also you'll hear from local actor Matt Palmer, who is currently in a production of Shrek the Musical. So all about that. But right now, here is my talk with Omar Sharif Jr.
No pressure, though.
I am joined on the phone by GLAAD spokesperson Omar Sharif Jr. Omar, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's so good to be on today.
I wanted to talk to GLAAD specifically because they do a lot of work with LGBT people and the media. And I'm curious for yourself, being both LGBT, an actor, and the grandson of a famous actor, how you came to be involved with this organization and what you think it's doing for people such as yourself.
Sure. Well, I was an actor in Egypt, mostly an Arabic language actor, and worked in Europe as well. I've only come to the U.S. about 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago now. But when I came out in Egypt in the height of the Egyptian Revolution, I was demonized by the media and by the press. I went from being known as Egypt's favorite son to public enemy number one. The day I came out, I was trending on Twitter and Yahoo, but mostly from death threats and letters of hate. And most of that negativity was really spurred on by the media's demonization of my gay identity. GLAAD actually reached out to me via Twitter and offered their help and their services to put my story forward in America, in the West, in a positive way, in a way that helped me build allies, realize I was part of a community, and afforded me the opportunity to move here once I was no longer safe to live in Egypt. So GLAAD does that. GLAAD works as a media advocacy organization, works with people to share stories proactively that introduce LGBT people for who they really are, not facts, figures, statistics, or moral and ethical debates, but, yeah, you know, brothers, sisters, sons, daughters, neighbors, coworkers.
You mentioned, you know, you're from Egypt, and we hear there's just so much misinformation or non-information that we hear out in the West about, you know, the kind of policies that goes on there, what goes on. What is the situation, or what was the situation for you like in Egypt, and what is it like now for people of your identity, whether they're gay, whether they're Jewish, and that part of the world, how bad is it over there?
Sadly, the situation is getting worse. You know, we all thought that maybe after the Muslim Brotherhood fell from graces in Egypt, it would get a little better for LGBT people. But sadly, it's actually gotten worse under the new government. Statistics were released just yesterday, and it's ranked the third worst place in terms of people's thoughts towards LGBT people, general thoughts. So 95% think it's unacceptable, 2% think it's acceptable, and 1% think it's not a moral issue, or that number didn't add up to 100, but it was something in those realms, I think. So it's not a great place to be gay, but, you know, that's why I'm working at GLAAD, because GLAAD has always been an international organization by sake of the work that they do. They, you know, work with the media, with television, with film, with the news media, and American media gets consumed and syndicated internationally. Yeah. It's our biggest cultural export in America is the media. And so, you know, people are poor in Egypt. They might not have roofs on their homes, but they get satellite dishes. They have satellite dishes, and they get shows like The Fosters, like Glee, like Modern Family. You know, I grew up with Will and Grace, and even though I didn't have gay and lesbian friends, I had, you know, Will and Jack and Karen and Grace, and that's, you know, you can't be what you don't see. It does make sense. So GLAAD provides that to audiences around the world, just a sense of community and hope.
You mentioned Will and Grace, and it was a show that I grew up with as well, and I think that was one of the first times that we saw, you know, a strong gay character or characters on a mainstream television show. And it seems like since that show went off the air, you know, half of all television has a gay character. What did a show like Will and Grace and subsequently, you know, things like Glee, what did they do towards mainstream society's acceptance of gay people, do you think?
You know, I really think you just have to look at public opinion numbers and the shift in public opinion towards LGBT acceptance and understanding. And we've seen a vast leap in that since these days, since Ellen came out, since the Will and Grace of the world. If you look at just the Emmy Awards, which were just released last week, the nominees for it, there are so many LGBT inclusive shows and so many open LGBT people. You have people like Laverne Cox being nominated for outstanding performance, guest appearance in a comedy series. When did we ever see a transgender person become nominated for an Emmy? That's groundbreaking and historic. And there's, you could go on from The Normal Heart to just about so many. You have Matt Bomer, Joe Mantello, Jim Parsons being nominated. You have a whole bunch of TV shows and actors being nominated for LGBT inclusivity. So it's just it's really a great time right now.
The note on Laverne Cox I want to touch on, because, you know, when we often hear people talk about LGBT, they talk about gay, lesbians, and bi, but it's only been in the last year, couple of years, that we've really seen transgender issues come to the forefront. And I know even within that community, there's still a lot of unsureness, there's a lot of negativity, a lot of misinformation. What has somebody like like Laverne Cox done for awareness of trans issues, and how much of part of the LGBT community are they?
Well, you know, I think having an open and out trans woman be recognized for her work is just, it's a major win. Like, every time I see Laverne Cox, she's doing something new and major and groundbreaking, like being on the cover of Time magazine. And that does so much in shifting the culture. So, We need to take a moment, though, to celebrate it and let it inspire us, but also do more and not just settle, because who says she has to be the only one? We need to open the door further, really.
10 years ago, there was one U.S. state that had legalized gay marriage, and now there are 18, I believe, 18 or 19, and many of them have come within the last couple years. People are calling, rightly or wrongly, people are calling Obama the first gay president. In your opinion, how has he been? What do you think his record is like on the issue of equality and LGBT rights?
Well, I think Obama has really been that change personified that we've seen in America, because he came into office not necessarily being in support of gay marriage and of marriage equality, but his views shifted, as did much of America's over a short period of time. I think the fall of parts of DOMA just last year in the Supreme Court played a big role in some of these more recent legal challenges and changes that we're seeing in a lot of states. But this is something that was coming. As, you know, generational change was happening, and with that, people's ideas of who LGBT people are, and as we've been seeing that shift in support, which I argue has to do with media advocacy and introducing people to LGBT people, this is hopefully going to be a natural progression. We're going to see the ball continue to roll, I think.
There are some who have compared this current fight, the gay rights movement, with the women's rights movement and the civil rights movement. And, you know, obviously that was a big part of what happened in Egypt as well in the last few years. Do you see any correlation or comparison between those?
You know what? I do. For example, sometimes I point to the women's right to choose, with the pro-choice movement and whatnot as well. And I say, look, they've had some rollbacks recently in some states. So it's not only about advocating and educating and pushing forward. You also have to protect what has been achieved. You can never really take your foot off the gas with protecting rights. So, we got to keep charging forward and keep doing what we're doing. We're doing great in terms of television representation, in terms of visibility, in terms of positive, proactive storytelling. We're not doing so great in terms of diversity. Most of the representation we're seeing are mostly white men, gay white men in television. So we could always be doing more. That's our job at GLAAD, is to keep, pushing the envelope a bit further. But we're going to keep doing that. We need to work with the film industry. GLAAD released a film report last year, and we have another one coming out in just a couple of months, where we saw that out of 122 major releases by the six major studios, there was a very few number, less than a dozen, of openly LGBT characters. And some of those were as quick as, a flash of an openly gay news character on TV, a news anchor on TV. So we need to do more in terms of the film, because, like I said, it's entertainment is our biggest cultural export, and we could also be shifting the conversation internationally and globally in places like Russia and Africa, where this content is being consumed.
Speaking of diversity, do you think now that you're in the biggest entertainment mecca in the world, that you'll try to get back into acting and maybe portray some more diverse LGBT characters?
Actually, I just recently signed on to do a project, a TV show. It hasn't been announced yet, so I'd be remiss to say its name before the official announcement, which is coming in 2 weeks, but stay tuned. I'll be playing my first openly gay character on a soap opera.
How do you find, in general, the LGBTQ across the Arab world? I mean, some countries are a little more liberal and forgiving than others, and some not. And what would you like to see happen within Arab countries to foster more acceptance?
I think legal protection is always a good first step. Without legal protection, it's up to the, leaders of the day, and that makes for a very fluid and unbeknownst and unknown situation where you can never feel secure. You never feel security. So I have a lot of, friends in Egypt who are gay and lesbian, and the motto has always been stay quiet and, stay out of sight and just stay out of trouble. But I think legal protections would afford us the opportunity to at least live openly and visibly And then we still need to work on, you know, building the culture towards supporting that.
What do you make of you know, some states or some people that think, you know, that talk about this religious exemption or religious freedom, that you should be allowed to discriminate against an LGBT person if it go, you know, if it's in your religious doctrine? Like Arizona had something like that recently, I believe.
Sure, and you know what we saw is we saw business leaders from across America speak up and say, you know, this isn't just wrong; it's also bad for business. It's almost nonsense. You have the Pope Francis saying, "Who am I to judge?" And then you have these, you know, some politicians putting up these egregious bills that are just, you know, sometimes passing. I'm hearing because some of the politicians in the local states aren't even reading the full bills and realizing the full implications of them. But it, you know, that's very hurtful to families, and you know, to break down families and LGBT families is to break down community and to break down values in general, and it makes for a weaker America, not a stronger America.
It floors me sometimes just how angry and fierce some of these pundits get when they're talking about gay rights. Do you think a lot of it comes from fear? Is there something else involved? Do you think they're in the closet themselves?
Well, you know, I'm not going to put words into anyone's mouth. I wouldn't accuse anyone of that. I would say it's misinformation, probably. And, you know, sadly, we're seeing that, fortunately, we're seeing that shift where, you know, as we get more positive role models and more positive portrayals in the news media and everywhere, the information will change and these people will be better informed, hopefully, about who we really are as a community.
We talked a little bit earlier about sort of this generation shift, you know, how it's a lot of the older generation that's against equality, but our generation, the new generation, the millennials, sort of seem to be okay with, you know, they believe in climate change, they're okay with equal rights. Where do you think we'll be in 10, 15 years? Do you think the world will be much more accepting when the young people of today take over?
You know, I don't think it's just because of the young people of today. I think it's because views are genuinely shifting across the board. And I think we will be in a much better place, but we've got to keep pushing forward. We can't leave that to chance. Like I said, we've seen rollbacks in the pro-choice movement. So you got to keep pushing forwards and never let the chance of you rolling backwards at all.
Well, Omar Sharif Jr., with GLAAD, you guys do fantastic work, and we look forward to the official announcement of your TV show coming up, and thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Alrighty, take care. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And once again, that was actor and GLAAD spokesperson Omar Sharif Jr. And, you know, speaking of people that go through struggles in life, whatever it is, you know, being gay, being Jewish, depression, mental illness. I want to give a shout out to someone I've met recently in the cyber world, and we talk a lot about you know, our own demons, our own struggles between us. She lives all the way in New Zealand, but I'd like to give a special hello to Rhiannon. Hope you're doing well all the way over there on the other side of the world. And in honor of Rhiannon, we are going to play a song right now from the band 5 Seconds of Summer. This is She Looks So Perfect by 5 Seconds of Summer.
Simmer down, they say we're
I'm so down. Was 5 seconds of summer with She Looks So Perfect, and that goes out to Rhiannon. Coming up next, we have Vancouver actor Matt Palmer, who is currently starring in Shrek the Musical as the eponymous title Ogre. I talked with Matt about what it was like being a part of the Vancouver scene, playing such a iconic role for so many people, and you know, what about those gosh darn prosthetics? You know, what is that process like for him as an actor? So this is Matt Palmer. On the phone with me now is actor Matt Palmer. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
So you are in Shrek at Theater Under the Stars.
I am in Shrek. I am Shrek.
Yes. Now, I read this is your first time with Tuts in 18 years. Talk about coming back to an organization like that after so long.
Well, it's actually really great. I mean, my first time was, as you say, 18 years ago, back in 1996, and it was actually my first audition for any show, and it was my first show outside of a performing arts college I'd attended a year for previous to that. So it was really fantastic, a fantastic start to my career, and now it's over. No, I'm just kidding. And so it's really wonderful to come back. I've always said to my friends, peers in the industry that Tuts is a wonderful place to perform at, and I always think that, you know, you should do it at least once. And so I'm getting the pleasure of doing it twice, which is pretty great.
Now, you play the giant green ogre himself. Talk about that experience, because obviously this is a character that's been, immortalized in the films. Did you watch the films? What did you do to get in that mindset?
I have seen. I think I've seen the first two films, and I love them. I thought when the first one came along, it was a really interesting time. Pixar was really starting to motor along there and put out some great animated films, and Disney, of course, were continually putting out great films. But suddenly, out of nowhere, DreamWorks came into the fore and put out this terrific film that was. It actually really reminded me of the old school Warner Brothers cartoons. You know, the Daffy Duck, Bugs Bunny, where these cartoons were created originally to come before movies that adults would go and see, and they were very entertaining for children, but they had all of these wonderful references that adults could enjoy that would fly over the heads of the little kiddies. And that's what I loved about Shrek the cartoon. But as far as getting into character, the great thing about playing an ogre is nobody can tell you really, you know, that you're doing something wrong, because ogres are, you know, is a fantastical creature. It's wonderful. I've had the opportunity to play a few non-human characters, and it's so freeing because there's no rules other than, you know, being inappropriate in some way. You know, the goal is to be creative and find interesting ways to communicate as an ogre. As far as Mike Myers, say, you know, Mike Myers and finding my own performance in that, it's certainly an iconic character, so I have to pay respect to what Mike Myers has laid down before me. I can't, you know, change him dramatically. So obviously he's got a Scottish accent, and, you know, and there's certain things about the character that are true, that we keep true to in the musical, that were portrayed in the animated film. But other than that, you know, other than specific things, it's really enjoyable to find my own creative stamp on it.
A lot of people don't know that the original film was actually based on a children's book about 20 years ago. Did you get a chance to read that and get any insight that way?
Yeah, yes. Sarah Rogers, who's directing the show, she actually brought it in for everybody so that we could look at it. And it's a wonderful book. It's different in a lot of ways. I mean, in the book, Shrek actually had, like, laser eyes that he could, you know, start fires with, and he breathed fire. But the same sentiment of the character, which is the wonderful message in this, is, you know, that to be yourself, essentially, is to accept who you are, as you are, and love yourself in that form, whatever it is, and then, you know, eventually you will, if you can do that fully, eventually you will meet people, and you will make friends, you will fall in love, and will be accepted, as long as you can accept yourself. And so, that's the wonderful thing about the book, is that, and that the sentiment in the book, which is carried through into the animated film and the musical, is, you know, is that he is perfectly happy eating disgusting things. He's perfectly happy living in a smelly swamp because he loves that. And that's so that, you know, it's, the book is a little bit different, but definitely the sentiment, the most important part of it, is solidly there.
Talk about the makeup aspect of it. I read that you spend about nearly 2 hours getting greened up. As an actor, what's that process like for you, having to go through that?
You know, it's a lot of fun, actually. It's just a new challenge. Yeah, as I've said before, that I've been in many different shows where I've had to wear wigs, I've had to wear, you know, mustaches, I've had to color my hair, my skin, you know, or color my hair, to change the tone of my skin to be a different character, you know, and this is the first time I've ever gotten or had to wear prosthetics. And it's a challenge unto itself, because, you know, it somewhat limits how you can express your face. So you have to find ways to communicate emotional states in different ways other than, you know, frowning, for example. I mean, it does read, and you can see a frown and a smile, but you have to show, communicate a little bit more than that. And it is 2 hours. They're getting faster as we each time we do it, they get a little speedier, and figure out best ways to do it, and so on, as understandable. The only thing is, the real challenge of it is temperature control, because the weather, as you know, has been beautiful this last week, and that's the challenge, is trying to keep cool, ice packs under the fat suit, you know, and having people standing by to touch me up at every available moment, really, every time I come off stage.
The prosthetics must make an interesting challenge singing-wise, because, as you mentioned, you know, it limits the amount of facial movements you can make. How does wearing prosthetics affect you when you sing?
That's not so bad. You know, the only thing that it can affect is the prosthetics around the mouth have to be really secured down, because, of course, when I'm singing, I'm opening my mouth quite wide, and that changes where the prosthetics are sitting, and will can sometimes cause them come unglued slightly here or there, and then they have to be touched up. But it doesn't really affect or make it challenging to sing. It just sort of makes it more challenging to keep the prosthetics in the place that we want them. The only thing that the thing that makes it challenging to sing is trying to sing in a Scottish accent. Let me tell you, it's not a pretty accent. You know, we all like to hear it, but, you know, as far as a singer is concerned, it's like the you know, in order to speak in a Scottish accent, in order to sing in a Scottish accent, you essentially have to do the opposite of everything you've been trained to do as a singer.
what was the learning process for you in in perfecting the Scottish accent, because it's not necessarily the easiest of accents to do as an actor.
No, it isn't. It's one, in fact, it's one in particular that I've always found pretty challenging to do. I had a girlfriend a while back, a few years back, and her father's side of the family was Scottish, and she would just tease me relentlessly whenever I'd try to do a Scottish accent. It was kind of painful. But I watched a lot of, these days the internet is a wonderful place, and you can just Google Scottish accent on YouTube and you'll find, numerous videos, people who are teaching you, the best way to go about learning how to speak with a Scottish accent, the vowels in certain ways. So I have a good ear, so listening to it really was the best, most beneficial thing. I found if I just picked up a book and just opened it up and started reading it randomly, any page aloud with the Scottish accent, and I would, that would help me greatly. I'm doing pretty well now. I feel pretty good about it, but it's an exhausting accent, You can't stop thinking about it throughout the show. You can't just relax. Like, I've done a few other accents and shows, and I just forget about it once I sort of lock into it. But this one, you can't do that. You always have to be thinking about it. I do, anyway.
Shrek, the movie, was such a phenomenon when it came out, and it sort of started, I believe, a renaissance of the traditional classic fairy tale. It kind of started the animation movement that we're seeing so much of today.
Mm-hmm.
What was it about that film that you think just spoke to so many people of all ages?
I think it had a lot to do with something I sort of mentioned earlier, was just that it was so clever. It was so smart in that it had tons of cultural references that were very subtle. Some were very subtle, some were very, in your face, and so many of them were things that an adult could enjoy, and as I said, like that a child would miss and was supposed to miss, because it was something that was, maybe a little mildly inappropriate, but they would never get it. So it was just wonderfully clever in that regard. And then I also think that there's something about a fairy tale which speaks to all of us, because in the end, fairy tales, they always have a moral to them that we can all relate to hugely. We've all, in this instance, it's a bit of a twist on a fairy tale, but in this instance, of course, Shrek is an outcast, and he's never had a friend, and he's never been in love, and he's never had anyone love him. And we can all relate to being unloved or not having our love returned. We can all relate to wanting to befriend somebody and them not wanting to be our friend. And I think something like that is such a moving, it just creates such a moving story, and we can all, get behind, I think.
And, I know you've done predominantly musical theater, but as an actor, how do you think Shrek changed the medium of all? We mentioned that it was sort of the forefront of the animation movement, the forefront of the fairy tale revival. What has it done in terms of creating more opportunities for actors out there, if at all?
Shrek, the animated film, creating more for,
yes,
actors. Yeah, I'm not sure as that's, I guess it would be, it would fall into, say, voice actors. It certainly creates lots of work for voice actors, and there are many, and they're incredibly talented, what they can do with their voices and the accents they can do and so on. So I would say that that's probably the one thing that it's done. And of course, when they're turned into plays or when they're turned into musicals, that, of course, creates huge shows that, this show, I think we have a cast of 36 or something like that. It's just a huge cast, and you think about all the, on a Broadway show, that's a lot of paychecks people are earning. So
yeah, we've been talking a lot about fairy tales, so I'll ask you this: what is your favorite fairy tale?
What is my favorite fairy tale? That's an excellent question. Nobody's ever asked me that before. Let's see, let me think about that. I would have to say, I think probably Pinocchio.
Who appears in Shrek.
He does. He does appear in Shrek. Because it's another solid story or fable that we can all relate to. And in that case, it's wanting to be something that you're not, and perhaps, you know, can't ever be, aspiring to be something, because then you think that if you're that thing, then everybody will love and accept you. Again, we can all relate to that, right?
Yeah. You've appeared in a lot of brilliant musicals. You've played Corny Collins, Rooster, Tommy, Cat in the Hat. What has been your favorite role that you've played?
I think, without a doubt, there's one I played about 2 years ago, and it was portraying a real person, and I think that's why it was so near and dear to me, and that's I played Will Rogers in Will Rogers' Follies, and it was just a wonderful experience, because I had to do so much research, of course, because he was a real person, a vaudevillian performer, and everything, movie actor. He did pretty much everything in the entertainment industry. But through my research, I discovered that the man didn't have one skeleton in his closet. He was just a wonderful human being who only wanted to help people and entertain people. And so that, of course, put me in a position where I felt very responsible for representing him as well as I could. And it just turned out to be a terrific show. We were very proud of that production.
There's been a lot of talk and concern that BC and even the federal government may make cuts to the arts. I mean, and we're seeing it in some area. How do you find Vancouver to be as an artistic city in creating opportunities for actors?
I would say, well, sadly, I don't really see Vancouver creating a lot of opportunities for actors. I see a lot of actors creating opportunities for actors. You know, sadly, we lost the Playhouse just a couple of years ago, and that was a huge loss. That's one of our Canada's biggest regional theaters. And had been around for 50 years, and it's gone, just gone. No more producing plays, no more producing musicals, nothing. And it's tragic, but there it is. There's been no rescue. I don't see the government going, well, we can't lose this institution. We have to make sure that it stays afloat. It just goes. What I see mostly is new and younger theater companies that are being created by actors who want to create their own work, who want to create new and interesting work, and they're the ones who are getting it done. And the funding really isn't there anymore. It's just, you know, and we can see that when I hear that, you know, there's a musical coming up next year, and they're going to be following the theme of what Broadway's been doing recently, which is they're going to have all the actors playing the instruments in the show. I mean, it's any way that you can pinch a penny, you know, to get a show put up and still be able to help an actor put some food on his table, right? Or
yeah,
feed his family. I mean, essentially, that's it. And so, you know, sadly, I mean, that's my answer. I don't really see Vancouver stepping up. I see the theater audiences supporting us, which is wonderful. But as far as, like, the federal government is concerned or the provincial government, I don't see that happening.
Well, Shrek runs until August, I believe.
August 22nd.
August 23rd, yes.
Oh, yeah, 23rd is both shows. Legally Blonde closes on the 23rd, yeah.
Okay. So Shrek runs now until August 22nd at the Malkin Bowl in Stanley Park. I think everyone should go see it. Lovely, lovely musical. Shrek's been making the rounds here the last couple of years in the city. Matt Palmer, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Dan.
Alrighty, cheers. Have a good one.
Okay, bye.
And once again, that was Matt Palmer, and Shrek the Musical runs until August 22nd at the Malkin Bowl Theater Under the Stars at Stanley Park. We have another song here from 5SOS, 5 Seconds of Summer. This is Don't Stop.
You're like perfection, some kind of holiday. You got me thinking that we could run away. You wanna take you there, you tell me when and where. Wow, oh, oh. But then I asked for your number, said you don't have a phone. It's getting late now, I gotta let you know that everybody wants to take you home tonight. But I'm gonna find a way to make you mine. Don't stop. Tongue-tied, I can't escape it. I'm loving what you got, but then you push me off. Oh, oh, oh. Everybody wants to take you home tonight.
That was Don't Stop by 5 Seconds of Summer. And now my final interview is with the Iranian film scholar Jamshid Akrami. He is talking about the film Closed Curtain, directed by Jafar Panahi and Kambuzia Partovi. Jafar Panahi was given a 20-year ban from making films by the Iranian government on the charges of propaganda. Since that ban has been in place, he has made 2 films. Closed Curtain is the second. The first was a great documentary called This Is Not a Film. I talked with Mr. Akrami about the film, Jamshid, Iranian filmmaking as a whole, and sort of the whole idea of censorship. The phone with me now is filmmaker and professor at William Patterson University, Jamshid Akrami. Jamshid, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Dan. Pleasure to be here.
So I had you on here because I wanted to talk about the new film by Jafar Panahi, Closed Curtain. I know you yourself are from Iran and have close ties with Mr. Panahi. For those listeners not in the know, can you talk a little bit about Jafar's situation and how he is currently banned by the government from making any sort of cinema?
Yes, he's been under a ban for about 4 years now. He is not allowed to make movies for 20 years or go or leave the country, give interviews, pretty much, you know, any sort of artistic activity for about 20 years. And also, he's in a sort of precarious situation, which in the Iranian judiciary is known as the stay of the verdict, which is, or rather execution of the verdict, which means he has also a six-year jail term, and that can be implemented at any time, meaning that at any time the authorities could go to his house, arrest him, and send him to jail. So this is a threat that he's living under, and you can imagine that's not a very pleasant thought to have.
Now, this is his second film under the ban. His first was, of course, This Is Not a Film. And if the Iranian government were to discover that he was in defiance of the ban that they opposed, that they imposed on him, what could they do to him further?
Well, as I just mentioned, they can easily send him back to jail. And I'm sure, you know, they're aware, obviously they're aware that he's made these two movies, because the movies have been shown in festivals abroad and even commercially in many European countries, and including in this country, as you know, and Canada hopefully pretty soon. But I think they have decided to just keep him in limbo, meaning that they know that they have the option of arresting him anytime they want, but they'd rather to keep him in a sort of uncertain situation, hoping that the uncertainty actually could do a number on him. But fortunately, Mr. Panahi has been very bravely defiant, and he hasn't allowed so far for this situation, this ugly situation, to actually dissipate his creative energies, and he keeps, you know, moving on and being active as a filmmaker, even though he's incredibly limited in terms of the resources and the tools he has access to as a filmmaker.
Do you think now that Rouhani's in office, and he's been described by the West as of sort of a more moderate and a centrist, do you think now that somebody like him is leading the country that people like Jafar and other dissidents might receive more leniency?
Well, this is what people were hoping right before the election of Mr. Rouhani. They thought, you know, there'll be an area of openness, and things will change a little bit, but unfortunately nothing has changed, and the kind of changes that would lead to a resolution in Mr. Panahi's case needs to be a little more radical, and unfortunately those changes are not on the horizon.
Now, you yourself last year made a film about this very issue, the sort of the censorship of film in Iran, called A Cinema of Discontent. What can you tell us about that? And you know, apart from Jafar's story, what else have you discovered about censorship of certain media in Iran?
Well, no Iranian media is free of censorship, unfortunately, since the Islamic government took over. And not that Iran was a free country before that. Even under the Shah, there was censorship of the media. But that kind of censorship was more of a political nature, the sort that you can see in almost every authoritarian country. But unfortunately, after the Islamic Revolution, now we have these new codes of censorship that are based on religious codes, basically, according to which, for example, a woman's hair must be covered all the time, or no physical contact, even the slightest type of physical contact is allowed between men and women. And you can imagine what kind of incredible restrictions that could cause for the filmmakers, when a filmmaker, for example, needs to show a woman at home. They have to show her veiled, actually, and that's not consistent with the realities in Iran. No Iranian woman would wear a scarf at home, but that's the kind of things you see in Iranian movies. And in a funny sort of way, the Iranian movies are all tarnished right now because of codes like that. You know, they show a sort of sanitized or maybe fabricated version of reality as opposed to how it really is. So this is what really prompted me to make the movie a cinema of discontent about the censorship in Iran, because I thought that was a unique case in the history of cinema, and somebody needs to make a document of that situation, which is a very unfortunate situation.
There are so many great filmmakers in Iran. Jafar, we've talked about yourself. Partovi, who made the film with Mr. Panahi. Kiarostami, of course, is the big one, and Bahman Ghabadi. What do Iranian filmmakers bring to the world of cinema as a whole?
Dan, let me first thank you for mentioning my name along those names. I'm certainly not in that rank. I'm not. I wouldn't even consider myself a professional filmmaker. I'm a professor, but because of my interest in Iranian cinema, I've made several movies about Iranian cinema. So. But in terms of what those directors bring to international cinema, I would say maybe a breath of fresh air. Some people have called Iranian cinema that the anti-Hollywood cinema, and anti in the sense that it gives you the kind of things that you can't find in Hollywood cinema or in the more commercialized Western cinema. It's a cinema which is deeply rooted in the and affected and inspired by the Italian neorealism of the post-war Italy, and they have made a sort of Iranian version of that kind of neorealism. So, and also at the same time, it was a breath of fresh air because people, and this is why in one of my movies. I've called it friendly persuasion, and I think that's a very apt description for Iranian cinema in general, because the most messages that come out of Iran are of a sort of hostile nature and, you know, related to wars and hostage takings and the nuclear crisis. But then all of a sudden you see these Iranian movies and they carry very, very different messages, humanistic messages, messages of, you know, of a definitely moral nature, a higher moral nature. And that's what sort of caught the rest of the world, at least the rest of the cinema world, by surprise. And I think that counts for that's what basically accounts for the success of Iranian cinema abroad.
Why do you think that the Iranian government is opposed to cinema as a whole? Is it because it's considered a Western decadence?
Yes, they have mentioned that. But then if they think like that, you think that they should be honest and ban cinema for good in Iran. And in the early days of the revolution, actually, there were some discussions of banning the cinema. Some mullahs suggested that, you know, cinema is something impure and un-Islamic and, as you mentioned, brings the Western decadence into the country and it should be banned. But then they realized that cinema, just like radio and television, could be a very effective propaganda tool. So decided to keep the cinema, but turn it into, as they call it, an Islamic cinema. Nobody still knows what an Islamic cinema is. You know, it sort of defies any sort of definition. But that's what they decided to do, and that's also how they started to implement such crazy kind of censorship and. So now they think they have a kind of cinema that they are comfortable with, and it's a very tightly monitored and controlled cinema. But then again, you do have filmmakers such as the ones that you mentioned, Mr. Panahi, Kiarostami, Ghabadi, who don't necessarily follow the government line as much as they could. And sometimes they've had to pay a price for this. Mr. Panahi cannot work officially in Iran. Mr. Kiarostami is making movies outside of Iran. Mr. Qobadi had to flee the country, basically, after he made an underground movie, No One Knows About the Persian Cats, some 3 years ago. So they're paying a heavy price for not following the government's line, but that's another unfortunate fact of life in Iran, that either you have to be a pro-establishment filmmaker in Iran, or if you're independent, you're going to have a lot of troubles. You know, and I should mention that there are only those two kinds of filmmakers in Iran. An anti-government filmmaker cannot exist in the country because dissent is not allowed in the Islamic Republic. And if you're a dissident filmmaker, you'll be either thrown in jail or banned from working, or, you know, forced to live in exile.
Well, the film is Closed Curtain by Jafar Panahi. It's a fantastic film. I encourage everybody to check it out. Professor Jamshid Akrami, thanks so much for joining me today.
My pleasure, Dan. Thank you.
Alrighty, have a good day. Cheers. Bye-bye.
You too.
And that was Iranian film scholar and professor at William Patterson University, Jamshid Akrami. The film Closed Curtain by Jafar Panahi and Kambuzi Partovi is out now. I highly recommend it. It is a great, great film. My thanks to Mr. Akrami. My thanks to Matt Palmer. And, of course, my thanks to Omar Sharif Jr. This has been Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby. Stay tuned for Strep Throat Radio with Matt Woodford, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.